You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hello and welcome to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Later in the show, I'm going to have a great interview with John Hoffman of the Cato Institute, who will bring us the latest on all of the big Middle East news, including U.S.-Iran talks, the situation in Yemen, and also the escalation in Gaza. But first, here are some of the biggest headlines from this week. After 2 months of U.S. airstrikes that have killed at least 200 civilians, President Trump announced a ceasefire with Yemen's Houthi militants. The Houthis agreed to stop attacking U.S. ships, but said they would continue their attacks on Israel and Israeli-linked merchant vessels until the war in Gaza comes to an end. Around the time of Trump's announcement, a U.S. fighter jet careened off an aircraft carrier and became the second American military plane involved in the assault on Yemen to sink in the Red Sea in 8 days. The Trump administration plans to deport migrants of various nationalities to war-torn Libya, despite opposition from both factions that claim to be Libya's rightful rulers, according to Reuters. Refugee advocates say the deportations would violate the international legal principle of non-refoulement, which prohibits forcefully sending migrants to a dangerous place. But this rule seems not to be top of mind for the Trump administration. Back in January, according to a new report from the Washington Post, several officials from the Trump administration asked Ukraine if it would be willing to take U.S. deportees. India launched its deepest and deadliest strikes within Pakistan in decades, and Pakistan claims to have shot down 5 Indian warplanes and a dozen drones. India initiated the hostilities between the two nuclear-armed powers in the wake of a terrorist attack in the disputed region of Kashmir that India blamed on Pakistan. On the Non-Zero podcast, Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute said the terrorist attack could have been a sort of false flag operation.
You know, this wasn't a sophisticated attack. This was 3 men, I think, with Kalashnikovs. Pakistan is aswim with Kalashnikovs, you know, and has been ever since the 1980s and the Afghan War. Criminal groups have them, but many private security guards have them. And so it really is not difficult, you know, for Islamist radicals in Pakistan to get their hands on simple weapons of this kind. On the other hand, you know, Pakistan is still suffering very savage terrorist attacks of its own at home by Islamist terrorist groups based in Afghanistan. Now, of course, these groups have a huge agenda of their own to cause a war between India and Pakistan. If you can get the Indians to destroy the Pakistani state, it would be the biggest fishing ground for Islamist extremism that has ever existed, dwarfing Afghanistan under the Taliban or northern Iraq under ISIS.
So it could have been freelance Islamists who wanted Pakistan to get blamed, even though Pakistan had nothing to do with it.
45% of Americans say it is very or fairly likely that there will be a new world war in the next 10 years, according to a new poll from YouGov. Now, by recent standards, this level of concern is not particularly high. In a YouGov poll from last year, 61% of Americans said that a world war was, quote, very or somewhat likely by 2034. The Trump administration's proposed NASA budget would realign the agency toward the priorities of Elon Musk's SpaceX, adding $1 billion in funding for a Mars mission amid deep cuts to other programs. Musk is hoping to launch an unmanned rocket to Mars in 2026, and it looks like NASA may now have enough funding to help foot the bill. As NZN wrote last month, Musk has exerted a remarkable level of control over NASA in the early days of Trump's second term. If you want to learn more about that, you can head over to nonzero.org and look at our article on the topic. Sam Altman will give you 150 world coins if you stare into his orb. The orb, now in storefronts in select U.S. cities, is a spherical camera operated by World, an Altman-backed blockchain company and cryptocurrency creator. By scanning your iris, the orb basically creates a biometric key that will allow vendors online to differentiate you as a human from the many bots that now proliferate on the internet. Visa, Stripe, and some dating apps have already signed on to the idea, but not everyone is so enthusiastic. One attendee at World's San Francisco launch told the Washington Post that she wasn't thrilled about scanning her eye, but did so, quote, for the free crypto, end quote. Now, that free crypto is currently worth about $154, according to Coinbase. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced an escalation of military operations that Israeli officials said will involve the forcible relocation of most Gazans to the southern end of the Gaza Strip. According to an international law manual from the International Committee of the Red Cross, forced displacement is illegal unless, quote, imperative military reasons so demand, end quote. Netanyahu's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, said the relocated Gazans, quote, will be totally despairing, understanding that there is no hope and nothing to look for in Gaza, and will be looking for relocation to begin a new life in other places, end quote. Next up, I'll be joined by John Hoffman of the Cato Institute to talk about that sort of remarkable situation going on in Gaza and all of the other biggest Middle East news of the week. I hope that you'll stick around. Hey, John, how you doing?
Doing all right, man. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you on. Why don't I go ahead and introduce you? So you are John Hoffman, a research fellow at the Cato Institute and an adjunct professor over at George Mason University. You focus on the Middle East, and of course, there's a lot of news always in the Middle East, but in particular these past couple weeks. So I'm very excited to have you on to talk about it. I think where I wanted to start this conversation is you've argued in the past that it's time for a kind of fundamental reevaluation of the relationship between the United States and Israel. Now, one interesting trend in the past couple of weeks is that it seems as if Trump, in some ways, is bucking the prior version of the U.S.-Israel relationship, right? He's reached a deal with the Houthis that does nothing to protect Israel, even though that's often a point of concern. He's, you know, going forward with U.S.-Iran negotiations, even though Israel would prefer a military option. So, you know, ahead of his trip to the Middle East next week, do you think that Trump is trying to carry out some sort of reevaluation of the U.S.-Israel relationship?
So let me first kind of just lay out the argument for the fundamental reevaluation. So the way that I approach the U.S.-Israel relationship is this idea that Israel is a strategic asset for the United States. You know, there are eyes and ears in the Middle East, this America's unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Middle East. But I challenge this notion because this idea of Israel as a strategic asset really, you know, was birthed from the Cold War. The idea that the United States through Israel would be able to, and through other actors in the region, would be able to try and box out the Soviets from the Middle East. That rationale obviously died with the Cold War. And since then, the U.S.-Israel relationship has been justified on a number of other, try to be rooted in another, a number of other strategic rationales, whether it be the global war on terror, overall just intelligence for the United States, a hedge against the Iranian aggression in the region. But I often argue that none of these really hold up to scrutiny. And the real crux of the U.S.-Israel relationship, this special relationship that John Kennedy first referred to it as, is the unparalleled amount of military aid that the United States bestows upon Israel, over $300 billion since World War II, adjusted for inflation, this diplomatic cover that the United States provides for Israel, most often at the United Nations, and a slew of weapon sales and intelligence cooperation and other forms of assistance. So those are structural underpinnings of the U.S.-Israel relationship. And what we've seen with Trump and what we've seen with other administrations is there's often tensions on the surface, whether it be, you know, think back, you know, with Obama, think back to, you know, Iran and the JCPOA. You can think back to George Bush Sr. in the settlements, or think back to Reagan in Lebanon. So there's often been tensions in this relationship, but none of them have really challenged this underlying structural foundation. And I would say that what we're seeing with Trump is a continuation of that pattern of this these tensions kind of at the surface level. And with Trump, it's over, you know, wanting negotiations with Iran, kind of seeing what's happening with the Houthis, saying, you know, what the hell are we doing? You saw the Signal chat, J.D. Vance saying, you know, I hate bailing out Europe again. You know, so it's that kind of sentiment here. And also we've seen even just today a lot of reports of Trump's frustration regarding Gaza and Netanyahu being, you know, adamantly against any sort of deal. So I think this is really more surface level. Trump's really not challenging the underlying foundations of the relationship. So that's just a long-winded way of saying I don't think this is the reevaluation per se yet.
Right. Yes. One thing that I think is kind of interesting, and we can maybe go into some of these different kind of things that have happened, you know, one at a time, because there is a lot to disentangle, but as from what I can tell, it seems as if there's sort of increasingly, you know, whereas certain previous U.S. presidents seemed more willing to build the broader U.S. strategy for the region around Israeli interests in many ways, it seems as if Trump really kind of is more frustrated by the idea of having to limit his own actions in the region and line them up with Israel's interests, whereas everything that happens in what Trump perhaps views as within Israel and within Gaza and the Palestinian territories, he seems much more willing to give Israel a pretty completely free hand. Like you noted, he's changed nothing about arms sales. He's had very little to say about Gaza. So maybe that is the kind of split.
No, I completely agree. I think that's a really good overview of it, is because on the one hand, you see really no change regarding arms sales, military aid, and things like that. But then you see with Trump, and part of the base that brought him to power is this idea of, you know, what the hell are we doing in the Middle East? You know, we need to start pulling back, you know, whether it be because of strategic reasons, whether it be because of economic reasons, the United States, $36 trillion in debt, $2 trillion a year deficits, you know. So this is part of the base that brought Trump to power. And I think that Signal chat leak, those leaks are so insightful, because it shows, you know, J.D. Vance in there saying like, oh, why are we bailing out Europe? You know, we've seen the past couple of weeks, the two, I think it was the two F-18s that were lost off the aircraft carriers. We see just since Trump's new campaign, I think that was launched, you know, March 15th or March 18th, $1 billion had been spent. You know, this is just the epitome of strategic malpractice. And I think Trump's deal with the Houthis in particular is a very, you know, America first move, if you will, saying, you know, we're getting nothing out of this. And it's not moving the needle. So, you know, we're not going to continue.
Yeah. I mean, is that your read? Is it basically that, because it is a sort of unusual thing to have happened, right? It's a month and a half of fairly intense bombing. It kind of came out of nowhere. It didn't seem very high on the agenda. And then all of a sudden we're at war with the Houthis, and then all of a sudden we're not. So is your read basically just that he felt that we weren't going to win this one and we needed to move on? Or, you know, is it because Mike Waltz left as national security advisor? You know, how are you thinking of that?
So I think it's a little too early to tell. I hope what it is a recognition that this was a, you know, fruitless, open-ended, congressionally unauthorized campaign, and, you know, let's just cut our losses and get out. A little too early to tell whether that is exactly what has happened. I think there's other factors here too. He's about to go to the Gulf. The Gulf states want this to end. They have no interest in, particularly Saudi Arabia has no interest in getting back at it with the Houthis. They failed miserably in their effort to dislodge the Houthis. If anything, they empowered them and pushed them closer to Tehran. So the Saudis are not fans of this. This is also in the context of U.S. negotiations with Iran. So if the United States is willing, you know, after all of Trump's, you know, the True Social tweets or posts or whatever, in all capital letters saying, oh, we're going to hold Iran directly responsible. We're going to go at it with the Houthis, fire and fury, et cetera. This should also be viewed in the context of those negotiations, trying to maybe, you know, put forward some sort of fig leaf to Tehran. Then I think there's also the Israel component of this. You see all these reports about Trump being frustrated with Netanyahu. We saw the same under Biden, but that wasn't ever coupled with policy. Perhaps this is a way by Trump before heading to the Middle East to say, hey, we're done, you know, taking it to the Houthis. We're done. The Houthis have already said, hey, we're going to keep targeting Israel. This deal does not exempt us from that. So I could also see a world in which this is a way to try and pressure Netanyahu saying, hey, we're cutting it, you know, our losses here. We're stopping our involvement in the broader regional escalation. You're increasingly going to be on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just such an interesting situation. And you know that he's going to, what are all the countries that Trump will be visiting next week? Do we know?
I believe it's Saudi, Qatar, and the UAE. And I believe, unless something has changed in the time that I was at the doctor's this morning, he is not going to Israel.
Oh, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. Well, one aspect that's interesting, do you want to explain a little bit for listeners kind of, you know, over the past, I guess, starting in the Biden administration and continuing until now, there's been these negotiations between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia about potentially linking the normalization of relations with Israel to certain concessions for Saudi Arabia, right? Maybe we'll give them a civilian nuclear program. Maybe we'll give them security guarantees, things like that. It's been a fairly hotly discussed topic here in D.C. What is the state of those talks ahead of Trump's visit?
Yeah, so I think in the context of this broader normalization talks, the whole idea was before the war in Gaza was we're going to have Saudi-Israel normalization. Excuse me. And as part of Saudi-Israel normalization, Saudi Arabia is going to get U.S. cooperation regarding a civilian nuclear program and a formal security guarantee. That latter one is, in my opinion, the most significant because that formally commits the United States to defending the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It would require a two-thirds vote in the Senate, so it's questionable about whether or not it would go through, but no Arab state has that. So that would be truly historic, and I think a historic mistake. Since 10/7 and since the war in Gaza, what we've seen is Biden in particular continuing to reach back for this normalization deal as a way to try and solve everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've written, you know, very regularly about how this will solve nothing, but we still see this overriding idea in Washington that the Abraham Accords are this kind of, you know, moonshot silver bullet that is going to cure everything in the region. But what we've seen is Netanyahu has different incentives, right? Like he wants to continue the war. He views his political survival as connected to this. He doesn't want to collapse his coalition. He doesn't want to be susceptible to the ongoing negotiations or ongoing investigations into October 7th, the intelligence failure surrounding Hamas's terrorist attack, his ongoing corruption trial, his efforts to try and subvert the overall kind of balance of checks and balances within Israel, you know, sacking the head of the Shin Bet and so on. So he has viewed continuation of the war as his ultimate imperative. And I think Trump, who wants his Nobel Peace Prize, wants his precious Abraham Accords, you know, to go through, is pissed because he views Netanyahu now as an impediment to this. He wants his, you know, this is classic Trump, right? Like he got the Abraham Accords, claimed peace in the Middle East. Then he can say Biden came in, ruined everything. Then he comes back, saves everything. But Netanyahu in particular is not willing to make the concessions that Saudi Arabia wants which is a commitment to a some form, some semblance of a commitment to a two-state solution.
Right. Right. And I saw a newsline recently. I'm not recalling where this was reported, but that there's now a potential conversation about giving Saudi Arabia a sort of access to a civilian nuclear program without stipulating that they normalize relations with Israel. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that is pretty significant. And we saw rumors of that under the Biden administration post 10/7 and during the war in Gaza that saying, hey, we're going to go forward with the components of the Saudi components of this deal absent normalization. And we see Trump, you know, toying with that as well, saying, hey, we're going to go forward with the nuclear component, a proposed, you know, 1-2-3 agreement with Saudi Arabia. Whether or not it goes through remains to be seen. But I think, you know, Israel in particular has been very sensitive about any other country in the Middle East, you know, possessing nuclear power. And we see it concerning Tehran. We saw it back in the 80s regarding Iraq. So this, you know, the idea of we're going to move forward with this absent any sort of Israeli input is kind of significant in and of itself. And I think, you know, again, coupled with this move regarding the Houthis, this is yet another signal saying, you know, hey, we're going to pursue what Trump views as U.S. interests in the Middle East absent any input.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's very interesting, too, because I mean, there's obviously that set of dynamics, but it's also funny because if you look at how sort of the original problem, insofar as it is a problem from our perspective, of the Iran nuclear program began, it's that we gave them the technology to have a nuclear program in the first place. So you know, it's an interesting balance between if you're going to give nuclear power to the Saudis, you better hope that they stay friends or else, you know, there could be issues down the line.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people forget is that this, you know, the desire for a nuclear deterrent within Iran predates the Islamic Republic. You know, it goes all the way back to the Shah, and it will arguably last after if the Islamic Republic falls. You know, this idea of a nuclear deterrent, it, you know, withstands any particular regime because the strategic situation in which Iran is faced in the Middle East, you know, you can see, I guess, why they are so obsessed with nuclear weaponry.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. And again, just interesting, the idea that, you know, the U.S. helped build that initial program, that initial civilian program, might do the same for Saudi Arabia. Just kind of a funny thing. But this seems like a good place for us to switch over to the U.S.-Iran talks. We're going to have another round of negotiations, I believe, this weekend. There's been a lot of ambiguity about the position that the U.S. is taking towards these talks. There's been some cases in which it seems as if they're calling for a full dismantlement of Iran's nuclear program, including its ability to enrich uranium of any sort. There's other ones that make it seem more like we might be headed back towards essentially the same deal that Obama got back in 2015 with limits on nuclear enrichment that are verified. Where do you think the talks stand at this point?
Yeah, this is tricky because we're seeing contradicting messages come out of the United States almost on a daily basis. We've seen everything from we're going to return to this JCPOA-esque 3.67% enrichment, which is required for civilian enrichment. We've seen that. We've seen this idea that Iran cannot enrich domestically. Instead, they have to import enriched uranium at these lower levels. Then we've seen this idea of a total denuclearization, the so-called Libya model. We've seen it literally changes on a daily basis. We've seen also this idea that ballistic missiles are going to be discussed as part of some sort of negotiation, which Iran has said for a long time, this is a hard red line. So it really changes on a daily basis. And I think the success of these negotiations depends on what the United States realistically goes into these negotiations hoping to accomplish. If your goal is full denuclearization in the so-called Libya model, that is dead on arrival. Iran will not agree to that. If you're going in trying to negotiate ballistic missiles, that is also dead on arrival. They will not negotiate that, particularly as their partners around the region, Hezbollah and others, have been, you know, seriously degraded. So that aspect of their forward defense is undermined. And that kind of leaves only, you know, the nuclear program and their ballistic missiles. So if you take away the nuclear program and the ballistic missiles are kind of, you know, out there to dry, and they realize that. So the success of this negotiations really depends on what U.S. demands are here. And if they go in demanding a JCPOA-like 3.67% enrichment, I've seen that some reports that instead of a 15-year sunset clause, they're going for a 25-year sunset clause. That would be significant. I would categorize that as a win, you know, and as something, you know, something that brings the Middle East back from the brink. And, you know, Trump, regardless of what Trump gets, he's going to spin as a win. But I think in that case, that would actually be a successful diplomatic endeavor by the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's interesting is, you know, if the full dismantlement thing truly is a non-starter, then even the continued existence of talks does suggest that they're not saying that it must be full dismantlement, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we see all these conflicting reports. I think a lot of them are driven by people who do want to undermine these talks. And if you look at the rhetoric of Donald Trump, and we've seen, you know, again, variation, but if these negotiations are still ongoing, and if it would suggest to me that the United States did not just walk in and drop on the table and say full denuclearization, no other option, because I don't think we would be at, you know, this third or fourth round of talks here. So I agree with you.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. It definitely seems, I mean, the interesting thing about Trump's approach to, it seems, all issues in the Middle East, or maybe just a lot of foreign policy issues, is there's these sort of two very kind of far apart poles, right? He's saying either we're going to kind of like bomb the shit out of them, or we're going to do a deal. So, do you think, how credible do you think that threat is from Trump? Do you think he'd actually be willing to go to war with Iran if a nuclear deal isn't reached?
I hope not. But so that's the thing is, you know, of course, for negotiations to be successful, this idea of military action in the case of failure is a form of leverage in which you're trying to, you know, keep in the background of these negotiations to try and advance your relative negotiating position. But the problem with Donald Trump is he's so unpredictable. You don't know what he's thinking at any given moment. I don't know if he knows what he's thinking at any given moment. And because there has been for decades policy inertia in Washington, D.C., pushing the United States towards confrontation with Iran, I think military action against Tehran, whether it be Israel supported by the United States or whether it be directly by the United States, Trump said if these talks collapse, it will be the United States leading the charge. So that is concerning, you know, and I think there is the possibility of real military action against Tehran's nuclear facilities, because also this is the guy who killed Qasem Soleimani. You know, a lot of people paint Donald Trump as Donald the Dove or as a restrainer. I don't think that's the case. I think Trump is often influenced by the last person he spoke to. And I would say in light of these negotiations, he means it when he says we will pursue military action if these talks collapse, which is why these talks are so critical.
Yeah, I mean, your point about it, you know, if Trump truly does do what the last person tells him to do, then the sort of infighting within the administration is all the more important. As people know, there's been a lot of, you know, we've talked about this on the show a lot, kind of battling between the different factions within the Trump administration, obviously the defenestration of Mike Waltz, or I mean, it's a nicer gig. It's a nicer gig in New York in many ways. So maybe he won't be so unhappy at the UN. It's a nice apartment, but you know, kicking him out of what is the center of power is interesting because he comes from that more hawkish wing. So I guess perhaps we could say that's a positive sign for people who are trying to avoid a conflict. I'm kind of curious, you know, obviously you work for the Cato Institute, you know, I guess libertarian, fair to say on the right wing side of things. From your conversations that you've had, you know, from people in GOP circles, maybe even within the administration, are you sensing anything that we might not be hearing about, you know, where the winds are moving there? I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, I think when you see kind of this neocon wing of the GOP, and I think Waltz is kind of the epitome of it, even Marco Rubio, some senators like Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton, who are pushing for this very, very hawkish approach to Tehran. We saw that report from in the Washington Post the other day that Waltz was coordinating with Netanyahu to try and, you know, there were parts of the Post article that I think were questionable, but that was essentially coordinating with Netanyahu regarding a more hawkish position on Tehran. And we see that coming up against the more skeptical side. People often refer to them as restrainers, or, you know, the slur of isolationist. You know, I don't think either of those are really correct, but, you know, we see the more skeptical side, like your J.D. Vance's, your Elbert Colvin's. So I think we see internally within the GOP a serious divide. And this is also reflected in the American public. The American public, especially, you know, in the base that brought Trump to power, really believe this idea of the United States being taken advantage of abroad, the United States, you know, engaged in these fruitless wars. You know, in Trump, when he was elected, he said, we're going to measure our success not by the wars that we get into, but by the wars that we never get involved in the first place. And I think that really rings true among an American public who is sick of these foreign entanglements. And we're seeing this reflected in the debate behind the scenes and publicly in Washington. And I think Trump also really believes that he was manipulated during the first administration by hawks and other neocons surrounding him. So this time around, you know, it changes by the day, but I hope the more pragmatic wing, if you will, the more pragmatic side of this debate ends up winning out. But it really is, as much as this is a non-answer, but it really is kind of a wait and see kind of thing.
It is a non-answer, but it's not a bad one because, you know, I think that is what we're dealing with. It's such a complicated sort of situation, but it is remarkable to see, you know, in many ways, the Biden administration being in part, maybe because it was sort of pitched as a return to traditional norms on a lot of different fronts, had very little interest in ideas like restraint, foreign policy. I mean, you saw obviously a little bit at the beginning, the fact that he did pull out from Afghanistan was certainly not nothing, was a major move, but, you know, not so far outside of sort of the window of American opinion, obviously, by that point. But the Trump administration does truly seem to be sharply divided in a way that just suggests that there are major changes afoot in elite sentiment on these issues.
Yeah, and I think it's part of this broader, you know, Trump really portrayed himself as this D.C. outsider, you know, D.C. being controlled by elites, the bureaucracy and so on. And this real foreign policy of American primacy, liberal hegemony, whatever you want to call it, is a very elitist foreign policy. You know, this is not reflected in the opinion of the American public. And I think Trump realizes this. whether or not he's the individual, you know, maybe right message, wrong messenger, whether he's the individual to really move this forward is debatable just because he's so erratic. But I think you're correct. We're seeing changes, and at least maybe at the rhetorical level, that 20 years ago you might have thought was not possible. And I got a lot of flack for saying this at an event the other day, but say Trump wasn't elected and say Kamala Harris was in office, right?
Right.
I think you would have already seen Israel take the fight directly to Tehran, because I think there is this pause that leaders like Netanyahu and others have in the Middle East when it comes to Trump, because Trump is so driven by his ego. Trump is so erratic. You know, he if you buck Trump publicly, he will take that personally. And that could result in actual, you know, if not policy change, it could result in heightened tensions, to say the very least.
Well, that's one thing that's been so interesting lately is that, I mean, just this week you saw Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, saying basically that their goal is to overthrow the government in Iran by, you know, arguing, you know, we basically did it in Damascus, we will do it elsewhere, which, I mean, is debatable. They didn't really do anything to overthrow the Assad regime. That's a bit of a stretch. But the basic argument that they're making is that nothing short of a new regime in Tehran will satisfy their concerns from a security perspective. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, especially if these talks, especially if we start to see more sort of slowness, dithering, you know, are you worried that the pressure from Israel to do a strike, or maybe even Israel will carry out a strike itself in order to kind of force the issue? Is that a thing that you're concerned about?
So I would say two things in relation to this, because I think it's really important. In the debate in D.C. and kind of the overall debate space when it comes to Iran, there's really two debates going on here. There's the one debate on nuclear nonproliferation and the best way to advance this. And then there's the regime change debate. For the latter, for the regime change debate, among those in D.C. and elsewhere who view the regime in Tehran as the chief problem plaguing the Middle East, anything short of a policy for calling for regime change is going to be viewed as a form of appeasement or what have you. Mm. And these two debates muddy each other because those who are very adamant about regime change view a nuclear deal as an impediment towards their ultimate objective, which is regime change. Now, if the talks continue to drag out, will we see Israeli action, whether sanctioned by the United States or not? I'm very skeptical, because I, going back to that, you know, discussion about Trump and his ego and him as a personality himself, Netanyahu would have to publicly buck Trump. And I don't think he could do that because of who Trump is. Now, if it was Kamala Harris, quite possibly, because he would know that he could take military action and the Republicans in Congress would bash Harris for trying to hold him back. But this is a Republican administration. This is Donald Trump. So I am not concerned insofar as Netanyahu just tomorrow, you know, launching a raid into Iran. What I am concerned about is, if you remember back to that missile strike by the Houthis at Israel's main airport, I'm afraid of something like that, because if that missile hit a couple hundred feet off to the side, that would have hit the terminal for the airport, and you would be talking about a mass casualty event. And my concern is, this is just, you know, an example, but my concern is that the talks are overtaken by regional developments. Because if something like that were to have happened, and you're talking about a mass casualty event within Israel, Netanyahu would obviously retaliate hard. And at that point, would Trump A, be able to, or B, be willing to try and restrain him? You know, that's a totally different ball game. So my concern is the longer that these drag out, the more susceptible the talks are to being jeopardized by regional development.
Well, I guess that's what's been a bit confusing to me about the Trump administration's approach here is that even as we've seen sort of an increase in focus on these talks with Iran, now we're even seeing this truce with the Houthis, I just haven't seen that same energy directed toward the war in Gaza. I have not seen comments from the Trump administration seeking super aggressively to get a ceasefire like they did before Trump came into office via the efforts in large part of Steve Witkoff, his envoy to everything under the sun. So I'm just kind of curious, you know, how we can square those things, right? Like, why does Trump seem to be sort of pulling back on Gaza, even if doing so could unravel all of these other projects?
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.